What price could Saudi Arabia pay if they're to blame for the death of a Washington Post columnist?
It is essential that we maintain a relationship with those in power in Saudi Arabia.
A migrant caravan puts immigration and the border back in the president's campaign pitch.
If you come and plead asylum at a legal port of entry, then you will be heard under our due process.
Speaking of the campaign, we're 2 weeks from Election Day.
I think it's actually fair to say Republicans have a good chance to add to their Senate majority.
It's time to get caught up on what's happened and what's next. With Rachel Sutherland, I'm Jared Halpern from Washington. What happened to Jamal Khashoggi? President Trump says it certainly seems like the Saudi journalist and Washington Post writer is dead. Khashoggi hasn't been seen since entering the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey, earlier this month. Reports detailing a grisly death have surfaced, though no evidence has been produced. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo traveled to both Riyadh and Ankara this week for meetings with the Saudi king and crown prince and Turkish leaders. He expressed confidence investigations from both countries will offer a clear picture. He also urged restraint about drawing conclusions before those investigations are finished, and said this about the U.S.-Saudi relationship.
I think it's important for us all to remember, too, we have a long, since 1932, a long strategic relationship with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
This week, I spoke with James Oberwetter. He was the U.S. ambassador in Saudi Arabia from 2004 to 2007.
It seems like there is no time in my memory that there hasn't been something testing the relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia.
President Trump told reporters if Saudi leaders are ultimately to blame for the journalist's disappearance, there will be severe consequences. But the president has also expressed hesitancy to cancel a $110 billion arms and military equipment agreement with the Kingdom. That's where we begin with Ambassador Oberwetter.
I think the Saudis report, and I'll just presuppose what it will not be pointing to the crown prince or to the king, but to someone or some others. And governments need to make decisions based on the long-term best interests of their respective countries. It is not in the long-term best interest of America to lose its ongoing relationship with the Saudis. So if we know for a fact what happened, and these are all very iffy questions and presupposing, that the top leadership was involved, we may never be in a position to acknowledge that as a government. And I know that won't go down well with a lot of people who are listening in on this, but the long-term interests of our country are best served by having a long-term interest with the Saudis for a variety of reasons. Iran is on the move. Iraq is still a very unstable place. The Middle East hardly ever gets better. I can't remember waking up one day and saying to myself, you know, it's better today in the Middle East. It always finds a way to get worse. And so we have overflights with our military across Saudi Arabia to places around the world where we need those overflights. We have a lot less to do with their energy these days than we did in the years in the past. We have a great deal to do with them in terms of fighting terrorism around the world, some of which has emanated from the kingdom before, and we have worked very closely with them on that as well. So there are a variety of reasons why that relationship needs to continue, but it is also important for us to get to the bottom of what has happened to a U.S. resident who went to Turkey to find a way to get married and ended up never coming out of the Saudi facility.
There has been a lot talked about the relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia from a security standpoint, like the one that you're describing. Does that mean that regardless of what the conclusions of this investigation find, that you do not see any change in say, that arms deal, that $110 billion in arms purchases from U.S. companies over the next decade that Saudi Arabia has pledged?
Well,
or should these companies back away from that and say, you know, not just with what's happened with Khashoggi, but also some of the criticisms now about
how these weapons are being used in Yemen. Should there be a pause to this program, or is this program too important to sort of the security apparatus that, that you've described?
No, if the U.S. government decides that there has been high-level involvement, a signal needs to be sent to the Saudis that that is unacceptable, and that we would expect nothing like that to occur again from them. I think Congress needs to be mentioned here, too. Senator Graham has laid out quite forcefully how he feels about this, and he would interrupt some of those relationships with respect to the defense spending that is going on. And that's hard for him. He's from a defense state. But it's very important that we send a message to the Saudis that that behavior, notice, you know, this is on the world stage, is not a behavior that we will tolerate. So we need to send some signals to the Saudis right away, even during the point of this, during this investigation. I believe, for example, that the 15 who were involved in whatever happened in that consulate, and I'm afraid the worst did happen, all of them instantly ought to be put on no-fly list. All of them instantly ought to have no visa policies from countries that are thinking seriously about this crime. They shouldn't be admitted anymore. They should be held in place in Saudi Arabia. So there are some minor things that can be done, and there are major things, like the one that you reference on defense spending. But Saudis have felt surrounded, and everyone needs to remember, by the Iranians, by what's happening in Iraq. They're insecure about that, by what has have been happening in Yemen. For years, I know they were criticized for never standing up on their own. Okay, they stand up on their own, and now they're being criticized for what they're doing in Yemen, and they're being criticized for what they're doing in other places. But returning to the question at hand, which is Khashoggi, never, never should that have happened.
And there are ways you think that the United States can send a signal, whether through sanctions or something else, that doesn't disrupt or undermine or tear away the relationship, the existing relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia, particularly on, as you point out, some of these security concerns.
Yeah, it is essential that we maintain a relationship with those in power in Saudi Arabia and not do anything to disrupt or cause internal strife. If that were to happen, I'm afraid we would be very disappointed with the leadership that might emerge if the royals were to no longer be in place. Clerics have a way of achieving in the Middle East that they do not in the West. And if you think that the mullahs in Iran are tough, you should meet some of the Wahhabi clerics. And if ever they had the reins of power, I think we would be aghast at what occurs.
I mean, as a diplomat, you know, I guess that, you know, diplomacy often is shades of gray, right? We often do work with countries who we don't always see eye to eye on every issue with. You know, the point is you have to deal with countries sometimes for the greater good. Is that the easiest way to sort of describe this alliance between the United States and Saudi Arabia?
I think that, Jared, I think that is a very good way to describe it. And a lot of messaging that you see on television where the Secretary of State may be smiling, maybe shaking hands, doing things like that when he's over dealing with as serious an issue as Jamal Khashoggi's murder, I will call it, is one thing. But what he says and what he does in that very tiny council of individuals who are meeting privately when they go off in private sessions, and in those sessions there'll be the Secretary of State, an interpreter, his counterpart and an interpreter, maybe a note taker or two. It will not be a large group of people that's closely held to the vest. And that is when the Secretary of State can and probably did deliver a very powerful message from the United States to those who are running Saudi Arabia.
So there's obviously a lot in diplomacy that we don't see publicly.
Absolutely. Now, you hear about watching sausage made sometimes when you're talking about legislative activity at the state level, sometimes at the federal level. It's not a pretty sight. In this case, with respect to diplomacy, where there are high-voltage issues involved, one never gets to see the sausage being made. But I guarantee you it is being made. And in this case, both our countries will be well served for us to find out what happened in this instance, to deal with it as we need to, and then look forward to a long-term, better relationship.
Mr. Ambassador, thank you very much.
All right, Jared, thanks for calling, and look forward to visiting again.
Central American migrants on a mission captured President Trump's attention this week, as a group from El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras traveled northward towards the U.S.-Mexico border. The president tweeted enraged about what to do to stop them. He threatened to cut off aid to the nations and call up the military to close the southern border, telling a campaign rally in Montana,
"Send the military to defend our southern border if necessary."
The president also accused Democrats of supporting the caravan of migrants because they figure everyone coming in is going to vote Democrat. Can President Trump order the U.S. military to close the border? In the past, the Defense Department has helped with border security. Both Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama called the National Guard to the southern border to provide support. But there's a little-known law that may limit the president's use of U.S. forces on the border. The 1878 Posse Comitatus Act, forbidding the use of U.S. troops for law enforcement purposes without the approval of Congress. Fox News senior Capitol Hill producer Chad Pergram told me President Trump cannot override existing border law unless it's deemed a national security issue, but he noted that could be vague. A Pentagon spokesperson told Reuters that National Guard troops are currently supporting officials on the southern border, but that so far, the Pentagon has not been asked to provide additional help. The estimated 4,000 migrants that were making the 1,300-mile journey said they weren't daunted by President Trump.
President Trump is selfish because he knows there are people with children who are also suffering. Even if he is the president of the United States, he will not stop us.
Late Friday, the caravan appeared to be turning around and regrouping. Mexico is asking the United Nations to help review asylum claims. Mexican Ambassador to the U.S. Geronimo Gutierrez told Fox News they are sympathetic to humanitarian needs, but
there is no legal ground on which Mexico can issue a permit by which people can just go through Mexico towards the United States.
A senior administration official says under a new deal, if someone manages to evade the system and eventually crosses the border into the U.S., Mexico will now allow them to be returned to Mexico. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo met with his counterpart in Mexico City. He thanked Mexico for their help with the caravan, but added the United States needs to do its part, too.
We've got to fix U.S. laws in order to handle this properly as well. That is an American burden, a uniquely American burden.
Immigration advocacy groups say President Trump is trying to frighten migrants to score political points. In a statement, the group America's Voice said people have been leaving the Northern Triangle of Central America due to war, human rights violations, weak governance, insecurity, poverty, and violence. It is a complex challenge that requires an intelligent analysis and a multifaceted, multilateral response. As is painfully obvious, President Trump is uninterested and dismissive of issue complexity, intelligent analyses, sophisticated responses, and respectful multilateralism. Fox News correspondent Griff Jenkins is on the border in McAllen, Texas, where he's been watching Border Patrol officers on the job.
You have an overwhelming spike in illegal crossings happening right now that has nothing to do with that caravan. You're seeing an increase of 80% of family units coming across, which is very, very unusual. And of course, all morning long, we had not family units so much as groups, mostly made up of middle-aged males that were really in a cat-and-mouse chase game of trying to get across. And the guys here in the McAllen, Texas, the Rio Grande Valley sector, the heaviest traffic in the nation, just working hour after hour, apprehending. We probably this morning got in excess of 50. They say each day is between 100 to 200 of apprehensions, and it's at an all-time high. In fact, I'll tell you, the stat that stands out the most is that the chief here, Manuel Padilla, in the RGV sector, tells me that compared to exactly this time last year in 2017, his station, the busiest in the country, is up 300% in the arrests of family units coming to cross over.
You were talking with some of the migrants, or trying to, some of the migrants who are being stopped by Border Patrol. What's going on? Were you able to glean anything from these migrants who are risking so much to come to the United States?
You do glean a lot, Rachel, and that is when they apprehend the illegals, they first determine who they are, where they're from, and then also why they are coming. And we find that most of them, and forgive me, I'm near a train tracks because it's the train tracks just a little bit north of the border. I'm just about a half a mile from the border. The migrants will try and come across and follow train tracks to get to major roads to get inland into the inner part of the U.S. and into Texas. But you learn a lot. Most of them all say they're here for work. They're here for a better life. But in the case of the ones that come with the coyotes, they're paying $4,000 and $5,000. They've been swept up into a booming business for the cartels. And, you know, when you have the Honduran caravan of migrants coming, they all say they're doing it for humanitarian reasons. And they plan to come just to our border and show up at the front door legally, essentially, and claim asylum, right? But what I was doing with the people that were paying money to infiltrate illegally, that is, at the end of the day, breaking the law, and so therefore they're going to be processed, and in many cases, sent back to their native countries of Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador. But here's the final rub, and the most important part of this, and that is the immigration officials say now that many, if not most, of their detention centers are at capacity, and they're full, so they don't have anywhere to put many of the people that we arrested today.
What's the process for seeking asylum? They show up, they tell Border Patrol agents what's going on, what's their story. Could they then be denied? Is that why people are hiring these coyotes? I mean, why even go that route? Because it sounds dangerous.
Exactly the case. That is the most important question, Rachel, because if you're here in the Hidalgo-McAllen-Reynosa, Mexico bridge, which is a very, very popular furthest southeast bridge crossing into the Mexico border, you have people that come every day that walk across, walk right up to our immigration officials and say, I'm here to plead asylum. You know, I'd like to seek asylum in the U.S. They then take you into an immediate border office. In many cases, they have multiple people, so it's sort of like a waiting room for the doctor or dentist office. But they essentially hear everybody to make their initial case. If they have some corroborating evidence or some proof that strengthens their case, that they're fleeing danger, persecution, crime, whatnot, from their home countries, then they go to the sort of second step, and they get into the further process of being given asylum. If they get to that second step, they're essentially given a court date, at which time, if they have relatives in the U.S., they can stay there and then go to their court date. If they do not get asylum, then they have to go back to their home country. That's the legal way to do it. That's the way that, in theory, the caravan of migrants say they're going to do it. It's just that they're in such a large numbers that it's really untenable for our immigration officials to process that way. However, the ones that choose instead to pay the coyotes are the ones that want perhaps just a better life, but don't feel they have the proof, can't meet the standard of proof for getting past that legal asylum at a border crossing, so they come illegally. At the end of the day, this is the rule. If you come and plead asylum at a legal port of entry, then you will be heard under our due process, and if you have a case, you'll progress further towards that asylum. If you come illegally and enter illegally, then you will be prosecuted for breaking the law, and that's what we're doing right now. Problem now is so many are coming that we don't have a place to put them.
Enjoyed your reporting very much, and stay safe, and see you soon. Thanks for joining me.
The Mega Millions jackpot hit $1 billion this week. That would pay down a bit of the federal deficit. Uncle Sam spent about $779 billion more dollars than he brought in this past fiscal year. The Treasury Department released its annual report for the fiscal year that ended September 30th. It showed a $779 billion deficit, an increase of 17% from the year before. More worrisome, the deficit is expected to grow, at least for the next few years, and could top $1 trillion, way more than any lottery drawing. Tax revenue was up slightly from this year to last, but so was spending by more than 3%. This week, President Trump says he wants his cabinet secretaries to find at least 5% in spending cuts next year. And Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell noted the need to tackle the biggest drivers of debt, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, telling Bloomberg News it's a bipartisan problem. But why does a budget deficit matter? That was my first question for Maya McGinnis, the president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget.
Well, that's a big one because it is actually really hard for people to understand why the budget deficit affects their lives at all. But it does in so many ways. So first, when we have a debt that's too high and our total debt relative to the economy is the highest it's been ever since World War II, but when we have a debt that's too high like that, it slows economic growth. Just at a time that we are trying to find all sorts of ways to speed up against economic growth. So that's like a big headwind we're creating against ourselves. Second, if and when we go into a recession, and we will soon, probably, given the business cycle, it leaves us without a way to respond. You have both monetary policy and fiscal policy, and we now kind of have two hands tied behind our back because our debt is so high. But I think one of the most compelling things to keep in mind is the fastest growing part of the budget right now is interest payments on the debt. And that means whether you want huge tax cuts or big new spending programs, like wherever you are in the political spectrum, if we're spending that money on interest payments, we are just throwing it away instead of having choices about what to do in our budget. So it hurts the economy. It leaves us ill-prepared for emergencies as they come up. And it puts a huge squeeze on our budget.
It seems the debt gets talked about a lot, but then doesn't really take a lot of action. I mean, you would think that cutting the deficit would be the easiest thing to do in Washington because regardless of Republicans or Democrats, they all want to do it. It's just a matter of how you go about doing it, right? And that sort of is part of the reason we saw the deficit go up this year because of spending agreements that were reached at a bipartisan level and then obviously the tax cut bill played a role as well.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you'd say it should be the easiest thing to do in Washington in that everybody nods their head when you say the deficit is a problem. Everyone agrees it's a problem, and more so the more they look at the numbers. The real challenge here is fixing it is not easy. And right now Washington is in a pattern of only doing easy things. So they love giveaways. They love to give tax cuts. They love to give spending increases. Those two obviously don't add up together into a sensible budget. And what nobody's willing to do is say, if we want something, whether it's a tax cut or spending increase, we need to pay for it. And number two, given where we are with so much borrowing already, we actually need to bring that borrowing down. That's going to require changes to our budget, looking at how to fix our entitlement programs, Social Security and Medicare, where we can make cuts in the budget, and indeed we're going to have to get more revenues to close this gap. And we don't have very many politicians at all who are willing to make that case right now.
President Trump, responding, I think, to this Treasury report this week, directed his cabinet agencies to find 5% in spending cuts for the next fiscal year. You know, obviously that's up for Congress to actually implement, and that's going to be easier said than done. But is that the type of action that's necessary? Would that be a sufficient move, a 5% cut across the board for these cabinet agencies?
Listen, I will never say that looking to make savings is a bad thing to do, because it's certainly the right direction, but it's a drop in the bucket. And here's why. Those same agencies that we're talking about cutting 5%, we just raised by three times that much over the past 2 years. So this quote-unquote cut still means that the agencies will be spending more than they should have under the previous budget, because there was this huge budget-busting spending increase, and if you cut 5% off of that, you're still spending more than we had budgeted. So it's a tiny cut, and in some ways it's actually an increase, and it's only on the smaller portion of the budget. If you really want to generate savings, you're going to have to look where the problems are, and those are in health and retirement programs. And the president has said he won't touch Social Security and Medicare. And on the surface, that sounds like a nice, reassuring political promise, but what it means is those programs are still headed towards insolvency. people who depend on them are headed towards across the board aggressive benefit cuts. And the sooner we actually fix them and make changes, the more secure they will be. So that's where we need to be looking for savings. In addition to discretionary spending, agency cuts makes total sense. I'm on board 100%, but it's not nearly enough if we're going to get serious.
Entitlement reform is something that has come up time and time again in Congress. But the problem, right, is this is a promise that the government has made to retirees, isn't it?
So what the government did is it said you're going to get this amount of benefits, and then it didn't charge any of us enough to actually fund those benefits. So we have a huge problem. It's very easy to make promises today for tomorrow. But if you don't put aside the money for them, how are we going to pay for them? You're going to ask future people to have to. So now we're in this really tricky situation where promises have been made, but resources to finance those promises haven't been put aside. So we have decisions to make, and there's no one right answer. But if we're going to finance all the promised benefits, okay, but we have to raise taxes very significantly, and we won't have resources for other things people have been wanting to do, talking about infrastructure or lifelong learning, worker retraining, those things. And there's no right or wrong here, but there's discussion that we as a nation need to have. If we want to do those things, we have to raise taxes. And if we want to make some changes, like, for instance, we could raise the retirement age. When Social Security started, the retirement age was 65 and life expectancy was 62. It's now retirement age is gradually moving towards 67, but we're all living into our 70s or 80s. So obviously those promises were based on a different life expectancy. We're now getting out much more because we're living so much longer that we have to adjust the program. And again, you can do it through tax increases or spending cuts or a combination of the two, but what you can't do is keep kicking the can. That really leaves the program vulnerable.
Can a strong economy help level this deficit issue?
Yes. Having a strong economy is one of the most important things that we can do to keep the fiscal situation under control and the economy strong. The problem that we have right now is that a lot of the very strong, solid economic indicators that we have are not likely to sustain. So the high levels of growth came in many ways because we had so much stimulus, so much debt-financed money put into the economy the past couple quarters. But that means it's more likely to lead to kind of a crash after that sugar high in the coming years, which is what most economists are worried about. You don't want to grow the economy by throwing money at it. You want to grow the economy by increasing our productivity, our innovation, and that's what leads to long-term growth. One of the things that actually does that is bringing your debt down. The other point I would make is that when your economy is strong, which it is right now, and I also think regulatory reform has been a big piece of what's helped that and helped the business environment, when your economy is strong is when you want to get your debt under control. It makes sense to run a surplus when your economy is strong and a deficit when your economy is weak. But right now, we have a strong economy, and yet at the same time, we have deficits so high, we've almost never seen them this high when the economy is strong. So something is off right there.
We'll have a new Congress in January. Do you anticipate the deficit being a top priority for the new Congress when it starts in January?
I'm worried. I have certainly not seen it as a central campaign theme. And like I've said, this is a moment politically where partisan fighting and promises of kind of free lunch economics, you know, tax cuts pay for themselves, spending so important we shouldn't pay for it, that these kind of promises are really taking favor over the realistic, we're going to have to make some choices. Budgets are about trade-offs. This is not a moment where people are really talking about these tough issues, and instead they are trying to beat each other up like crazy. It's an issue that does better when it's talked about in the election and voters come to understand the importance of getting our debt under control, and then there's buy-in for a political effort to make those changes. This election has not reassured me that we're going to turn our attention to it, even though we absolutely should.
It will be a story that we continue to follow, no doubt, as we continue to cover this election and also the budget and appropriations process that will follow. We'll check in when we get to budget time in just a few more months.
Terrific.
There are a few ways to tell we are getting close to Election Day. Besides the saturation of campaign ads, here in D.C., it's been sweater weather. It feels a lot more like November than the sweltering summer campaign. And on my brisk morning commutes this week, I couldn't help but think of someplace warmer, say, like Southern California. Of course, Southern California isn't just a nice thought for a cold morning. It's one area where next month's midterms will be decided. Orange County, the OC, as it's been known on that TV series, is a usually reliable Republican area, but Democrats are seeing opportunity. Josh Kroshauer is the political editor for National Journal. He writes the weekly Against the Grain column. He'll also join our Fox News Radio midterm election night coverage next month. I caught up with him on the trail in Orange County.
There are a half dozen seats that Republicans hold in California that are they're genuinely up for grabs or contested by the Democratic Party. And the hotbed of the action is here in Orange County, which has always been the Republican stronghold in California. But because President Trump is not popular in the suburbs across the country, not popular in California, certainly, a lot of Republicans who never had to worry about a tough re-election are all of a sudden running for their political lives. You know, I'm here not too far from Congresswoman Mimi Walters' district. It's a seat that voted for Trump narrowly, but it's also a very affluent suburban seat, and it's one where Trump is not, you know, he's lost a lot of popularity since the election. And the Democrat running against her, Katie Porter, is sort of an Elizabeth Warren protege, someone who's actually pretty liberal on a host of issues. But we're trying to find out whether it matters where the Democrat stands ideologically on the spectrum, or whether people are just so upset in the suburbs about President Trump, about his brand of politics, that it may overshadow no matter what flaws any Republican has that's running for office.
It's an interesting dynamic that's going to be tested, I think, in a lot of races across the country, because you talk about Orange County being, you know, sort of affluent Republican districts. That was not the base of the coalition that President Trump built his coalition around.
That's right. And I think it's important to remember 2016 was something of a realigning election, in that even though only a handful of states, including those Midwestern states that Trump likes to talk about, were the ones that flipped and gave him the presidency, we saw a lot of cross currents in a lot of states. So the suburban parts of the country, even though they've traditionally been receptive to Republicans, swung away from Donald Trump, and many of them voted for Hillary Clinton in large numbers. In fact, Orange County, which hadn't voted for a Democratic presidential candidate since 1936, since Franklin Roosevelt was president, actually voted for Hillary Clinton for the first time in 80 years. So you saw like the suburban Philadelphia, suburban Atlanta, all the suburbs, even in states that are red, swung their votes towards Hillary Clinton, while at the same time in small towns, exurbs, blue-collar areas throughout the country, Donald Trump made remarkable gains, and that was what allowed him to win Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan in the Midwest. And that dynamic is still with us today.
I know you've done some reporting as well on the record amount of cash being raised by both parties. Candidates across the board are just raking in all kinds of money, it seems. What was the figure? $1 billion now has been raised by Democratic candidates?
It's truly remarkable. I mean, the big story isn't that Republicans aren't raising money. If you just look at the Republican congressional candidates fundraising, you'd think they were doing a pretty good job. But
oh, yeah, no, they're raising money.
They're raising money. And if you just, you know, they did in 2014 and 2010 when they took back the House, when they took back the Senate, it's about the same number. I mean, if you look at the math, it's about the same as it was when they took back the House and the Senate. What's different is that Democrats and the National Donor Network, both in small donors and big donors, it's just through the roof. I mean, you have Beto O'Rourke, who's probably not going to win the Texas Senate race,
right,
raising $34 million in 3 months. That's more than Barack Obama raised.
That's what I was going to sort of lead this into, is you have a candidate like O'Rourke who is still not favored in that race, and actually in new polling seems to be losing some ground against Ted Cruz, who is raising all of this money, certainly more money than will probably be spent between now and Election Day. So what do we take away from this fundraising effort? I mean, does it show enthusiasm? Is there any sort of forecasting that you can do when you look at sort of the fundraising difference between candidates in these races?
Money is a good stand-in for voter enthusiasm. I mean, I like to look at how much money people raise as a sign for how much energy is in their district for that candidacy. We're seeing a lot of national small donor network. There's a progressive clearinghouse called Act Blue that is getting liberal donors to give money to a lot of the big candidates in competitive races. And it is truly historic that candidates that were no-name candidates last year are raising millions upon millions of dollars in a pretty short period of time because there's just so much energy among the Democratic base. There's just so much activism going on. You know, where it might have an impact is in the House, where there are a lot of races that members of Congress think are safe. That you might be in a conservative district that Republicans don't think is going to end up flipping. But then you have a Democratic candidate who's suddenly raising, you know, $1 million and has enough money to put together a pretty tough campaign. And we always see in a big wave election or an election where one house flips, some surprises. And if you have Democratic candidates across the board raising good money, you may see a handful of races that we never saw coming where Democrats end up picking up a seat in pretty conservative territory.
I think the other interesting midterm story this week is the emergence now on the campaign trail in the final 2 weeks here of South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham. What is his role now? I mean, the RNC is putting him out on the, he's going to be, what, in a dozen states?
Lindsey Graham, who always had a challenge from the right, who always faced some kind of conservative opposition in South Carolina, has become sort of Trump's best friend, his wingman, if you will. And now he's really become a superstar among a lot of conservatives.
I think people forget the animosity between Graham and the president. I mean, his cell phone number was released by the president at one point in the Republican campaign.
They ran against each other in the presidential race. Lindsey Graham said something about he was part of that Never Trump wing of the party for quite some time. So this is sort of an unlikely bromance, if you will. I know part of it is political, I think. Part of it is that Lindsey Graham is up for re-election in 2020. If he was not friendly with President Trump, he would be in serious danger of losing the nomination, as we've seen with folks like Sanford, folks like Jeff Flake, who have been much, much more outspoken in their criticism of President Trump. But I also think there's sort of pre-Kavanaugh Lindsey and post-Kavanaugh Lindsey. I mean, Graham always was golfing and had some kind words about the president, but it wasn't until he had that moment during the Kavanaugh hearings where he really leapt to the judge's defense that really solidified his support in Trump world and made him something of a superstar overnight.
It sort of speaks to what Mitch McConnell and other Republican leaders believe is the case, is that the Kavanaugh confirmation was a unifying force, that you have different blocks of Republicanism and, those who are sort of within the president's wing of the Republican Party, those that are in more of the old school establishment wing of the Republican Party, but everybody has unified around this Kavanaugh confirmation. Is that going to pay some dividends now, particularly in some of these Senate races?
Yeah, the debate has certainly come home, and that's going to show itself in these red state Senate races. And we're already seeing sort of the dividends coming through in a state like North Dakota, where Kramer, the congressman, is up by double digits against Senator Heidi Heitkamp, who's had a whole host of problems ever since she decided she wasn't going to vote for Kavanaugh, including publicizing victims of sexual assault that didn't want to be publicized and making mistakes in an advertisement. That's really gotten to her in a lot of trouble back home. But in Missouri is another race that I was actually just in the state a couple weeks ago, and Josh Hawley is a former clerk. He's a Republican nominee for Senate. He clerked for John Roberts. He knows the judiciary backwards and forwards. And it was a perfectly ready-made issue to really exploit when it became so nationalized, the debate over Kavanaugh. And he's Republicans think he's starting to pull ahead of Senator Claire McCaskill in another red state Missouri Senate race. So the base has started to come home. These races have become nationalized. That is not good news for these red state Democrats who are hoping to run on either local issues or health care. I mean, health care was the driving theme for a lot of red state Democratic senators going on the attack for Republicans who opposed Obamacare, support protections for those with pre-existing conditions. That was sort of the running theme in August and September, and then Kavanaugh renationalized the race in a way that benefited Republicans.
I'm excited, Josh, that you and I will be spending election night watching all of these returns coming together and hopefully making some sense of it for our listeners on the radio.
This is the Super Bowl for political reporters like myself, a midterm election coming up. So looking forward to being with you in New York.
That will do it for the From Washington podcast this week. Remember Lion Ted, the name President Trump had for Senator Ted Cruz during the contentious Republican presidential campaign? Well, next week, the president will campaign for Cruz in that unexpectedly close Texas Senate race. We will add that to our list of races we're looking at before November's midterms. We'll also continue to follow up on the diplomatic fallout sparked by the presumed murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi in Turkey. Between now
now and then. The best way to keep up with everything here in Washington and beyond is our top of the hour newscast. You can hear it on your radio, the Fox News app, or your smart speaker. For all of us at Fox News Radio, I'm Jared Halpern from Washington.